So, Tony, in the interests of just full journalistic disclosure here, it feels important to mention that you did not want to participate in this at all.
Yeah, I thought it was silly. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, 20 years is it's a long time, but it's a sort of an arbitrary number. And to make a celebration, to me, just felt like a memorial, you know? Felt like we were going over the side, and this was it. And then they'd run this show, and the next day they'd say, that's it, we're done, have a nice life. So, I didn't really want to participate in it.
That is not a joke. That is, in fact, Tony Kornheiser, peak Kornheiser, I would argue. And I can say that because I have spent years getting to know this man as his de facto television grandson, learning from and working with one of the greatest journalists and television co-hosts of his generation.
Otherwise occupied, I am pleased to be joined by our great friend from the ESPN Daily podcast, my grandson Pablo Torre.
And yes, this is Pablo Torre, as my grandfather just said there, host of the ESPN Daily podcast. And for the next 4 weekends, we're doing this side project in our feed. It's a kind of family history of 20 years of Pardon the Interruption, the sports talk show that changed Mike and Tony's lives and sports television and also sports itself. All of which means that I have been hanging out with this guy.
I'm Mike Wilbon from ESPN, co-host of Pardon the Interruption.
And this guy.
I'm Anthony Irwin Kornheiser, and I yodel on television for a living.
And as their show goes into its third decade now, in this time of extreme media upheaval, I wanted to understand how and why any of this even came to be.
First tape without Max.
So as Tony said up top, he genuinely did not want to do this project. It actually took Mike Wilbon calling him up from his apartment building in Chicago with me standing right there to help convince him.
All right, so I didn't mean to wake you if you was a nap. I thought I was going to message you.
Will you tell Tony that I'm wearing a tie for this, just so he knows how important this is to me?
What's that? Pablo says, by the way, I'm looking at him, he's wearing a very nice, expensive tie to do this, so he just wants you to know.
That's right.
He says, good, dressed like an adult. He's going to do it. He gets into these stupid things.
And you know what's funny about all of that? It is exactly how PTI started to.
So, Mike, I wanted to start by letting you pretend to be a screenwriter here for a second.
That's a big pretense.
So where does the movie begin? What is the scene that comes to mind when the movie of PTI begins in your head?
This is the summer of 2001.
Yeah.
I'm covering Lakers somebody, whoever they're playing in the finals. And Mark Shapiro calls. He had been the head of Sports Century. And Tony and I had been panelists.
Mm.
And I said to him on the phone, I remember exactly what I said, the first thing you're going to do is put us on TV. The second thing you're going to do is be fired, and justifiably. We met at 8 o'clock. We were still there at midnight. And then I sat in the car trying to figure out what it is I had just heard until 1 a.m. 1 a.m. Pacific time, of course, is 4 a.m. Eastern time. And I knew that Anthony Kornheiser would be walking his dog, Maggie. So I called him at 4 a.m. He answers the phone on the first ring. And I said, listen, it sounds like our lives are about to change forever. So you need to just listen to me for 15 minutes and not say a word.
The first time you heard about the show as a concept, when was it? Oh, what was it like? Do you remember that?
Wilbon told me about it. It was in the summer of 2001, maybe May or June, something like that, somewhere around there. And Wilbon said, oh, yeah, we're going to do a show on ESPN in the fall. What are you talking about? He says, we're going to do an hour show on ESPN. We're just going to go back and forth and we're going to talk. Well, who told you this? And he listed a couple of names. I didn't know these people. I didn't know anything about it. I just thought, yeah, sure. Okay. I said, yeah, let me know the day before we're going to be on so I can get a sport coat. That would be it.
So yeah, Tony didn't exactly know what went into starting a daily network TV show, and the adult charged with herding these two bald cats onto a set every day was this guy.
I'm Eric Rideholm, the executive producer of Pardon the Interruption. I said that I think that if this show is done right, it could be like a Siskel and Ebert on sports, where it could last for a huge long time because the relevance would be very high and the cost would be very low. Their chemistry was so special that if all we had was a single camera, two chairs, and a dangling light bulb, like we had a show. Their chemistry was that good.
And so they began to draw up a deal, but it was not a done deal.
How close were you to not doing it?
I had said no, because I get bored very easily. I don't want to do anything every day, and this meant going to a studio every day. I didn't want to do it. I was working on a book with Charles Barkley, and Charles said, he listened to the whole thing, and he just said, okay, you're thinking about not doing this? This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Okay, we're going to talk about this. You need to do this.
Eric continued forward on production, even with giant question marks pretty much all over the place.
When we all came on and we started creating the show, Tony and Mike were not under contract. They had not signed yet. Even though we were launching in 6 weeks, it was multiple weeks before they actually agreed to terms. But they did come in and visit. Tony came into the newsroom, and we had this young staff who had all moved to be a part of this new production that we were all very excited about, but had very little precedent. Tony looked around, listened, and before he left, stepped up to the front of the room, and he said, I'm about to sign a 2-year contract. I don't think this show is going to last 3 weeks. But I get all of my money, and I have 3 other jobs.
When you were talking to your staff at the beginning of this, Tony, you had some specific advice that everyone seems to recall, which is that
rent don't buy.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're not going to be here long. Don't get attached to this. Don't say, oh, we're going to be rich. I'm going to buy that house. No. No. It's like dry cleaning. Be ready to pick it up in a day and get out.
And then he left. And everyone was left looking around the room with the rightful question, I don't have 3 other jobs. Like, what does this mean for me? Now, I will tell you that while we were all quite rattled by Tony's first visit, Mike Wilbon came in later that afternoon, and I told Mike what Tony had said. And what Mike said was, do not listen to Tony. With Tony, the sky is always falling, and it doesn't mean anything.
But what Eric and Charles Barkley and PTI's young, terrified production staff, what they did not fully understand is what an existential shift this was for both Tony and Mike. Those guys weren't just selling out. They were basically betraying their tribe.
We're newspaper guys. We grew up wanting to have the jobs we had. All I wanted to be was a columnist for a great newspaper. Hello. I'm a columnist for the Washington Post. In 1988, I became that. I wasn't looking to go to TV.
We completely looked down on people who did television. We thought they were pretty boy poodles. We thought they had no talent across the board. The radio guys were worse. Because the radio guys, when you were in front of an athlete and you were taking notes and you were asking questions and there was a certain back and forth, they would go, just let me get this one in, okay? Let me get this one question in. How's the game tonight? All radio guys were slugs. All newspaper sports writers felt that way. 15 years later, what do? We do radio and television. We strive to do radio and television. So the worm turned on that.
Pardon the interruption, but I'm Mike Wilbon. And no matter how long we do this, I'm still a newspaper guy.
And I'm Tony Kornheiser, and I'm a print guy too. But Michael, this is the business we have chosen.
We go back to the world of newspapers and how it formed who they are in just a bit.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
So to understand why Tony and Mike were so reluctant to engage with the beast known as television way back in 2001, you gotta understand the sort of media world they came up in. Because the fraternity, and yes, it was and still is overwhelmingly dudes, the fraternity had a culture. The fraternity of sports writers, and I emphasize writers here, they had a code. And not everyone could get in.
Tony, when did you know that you wanted to be a journalist?
Journalist is a rather highfalutin term. I wanted to be a newspaper sports writer. And I knew from as far back as I can remember, 6, 7, 8 years old, something like that, that young, I knew that I wanted to be a newspaper sports writer. That's all I ever wanted to be. That's all I would be now if my life hadn't taken the turns that it took. In Sport Magazine and Sports Illustrated, I taped them to my wall. I mean, I go back as far as Robin Roberts, the pitcher for the Phillies, and Don Newcomb when he pitched for the Brooklyn Dodgers, and Willie Mays, obviously, so I was a Giants fan. And I put these up on the walls, and it wasn't until I was in college that I started putting up columns by Jimmy Breslin and Pete Hamill. I mean, I had moved away from the idolatry of just athletes and into the writers. I was more attracted to what was then called takeouts, profiles, long profiles of athletes. And that was the style of writing that I aspired to more than anything else. If I was really brave, I'd be an actor. Because actors are really brave. Actors literally take their clothes off. They go into accents, they go into character, they lose themselves in a part. I knew how to do it. I couldn't do it. People used to say, they would read the stories and they'd say, you're funny. And I go, hold on a second. I'm funny for a sports writer. I'm not funny. I'm not a pro. You know, I'm not out there as a comedian being funny. Those people are really funny. I'm funny for being a sports writer.
But Mike's journey toward journalistic self-awareness, that was a little different.
Was there a moment when you realized that being a sports writer was, in fact, the dream for you?
Yeah, when I was 21 years old. I mean, I knew what I wanted to do from the time I was 16 or 17 years old. When it was clear I was not going to be the next first baseman for the Chicago Cubs, I was not going to succeed Ernie Banks, I didn't have that kind of talent, then I wanted to be as close as I could be to sports, even if I couldn't play it. And baseball's the only thing. I mean, I was a good baseball player. I'm not going to be immodest about that. But I couldn't have gotten out of that. I mean, I could have played in the minors. I could have played professional baseball. Probably. I think I could. Other people thought I could. But not in the, not that. Maybe A-ball. Maybe some semi-pro thing. You know, but no. I couldn't play baseball at that elite level. So I knew I wanted out because I didn't want to do anything every day. Baseball's every day. Mm-hmm. And once I realized that, I'm like, okay, I'm done with that. I want to cover it. I thought every day. So, no, I knew I wanted to be a sports writer. That was the deal.
Tony is 11 years older than Mike. That's important to point out here. He'd already written for Newsday in his hometown of Long Island and was at the New York Times when he got the attention of a rival gatekeeper in the trade.
I'm George Solomon. I was a sports editor of the Washington Post from 1975 to 2003. I went to New York, went to an overpriced New York restaurant, took Kornheiser out to lunch, and we decided to offer him a job in which he would split his time between style and sports.
What was it like working with George Solomon at the Post, Tony?
George is the greatest. He knew who was good. He gave those people an opportunity. And the sports section at the Washington Post was extraordinarily democratic. You could yell and scream. You know, the smallest voice could yell and scream at the loudest voice. And I have great fondness in my memory for walking through the sports department at the Washington Post and knowing that whatever my status was, it didn't mean anything. No, it didn't. It carried no weight there at all, because anybody could say anything to anybody. And I think that made us all better.
And Mike, who is from Chicago, he didn't write for the local Sun-Times or the Tribune, the papers he delivered when he was working as a teenager. Mike got his start as an intern for two summers at the paper Watergate made famous.
So there are 20 of us. And they always explain to you how there are 20 of you and maybe two of you will make it. And two of you will make the cut. Two of you lottery picks can come back and work here. And so Tom was sick, had a cold, something. And they said, Tom Wilkinson can't take you to lunch, but Bob Woodward will take you to lunch. He'll be taking you to your luncheon today. It's just like, you know, seriously, there are people like throwing up in the locker room. It's like you, Bob Woodward, there's no, this is LeBron James taking high school seniors to lunch. That's what this is. And in today's parlance, and he took us to lunch, and who the hell knew what he said? Because you're looking at Bob Woodward.
George Solomon looked at intern Mike Wilbon and eventually decided to hire him full time. And from there, Mike and Tony's reputations grew, as did their voices.
Mike, you've been described as the best deadline writer in American newspapers. What did deadlines present to you?
That's probably the compliment that means the most to me I have ever received professionally. But sometimes the biggest games of people's lives, I was writing those games. I was trusted to write those ultimately because I wanted to go there on deadline and write it. I wanted to do that. There were a couple of occasions, all the Olympics, the great, great, great things at the Olympics I saw, Kathy Freeman winning the 400 in Sydney. And it was the first time I think I ever wrote through my own tears, sobbing at the result, but I made deadline.
He developed sources to where, you know, when he was at the Washington Post and today when he's at ESPN, no one has better sources and better contacts in the world of sports than Michael Wilbon.
Tony, on the other hand, was both a magazine-ready stylist and a critic. Not so much the mixer and the mingler type, but the guy who would say it like he saw it and often say it sarcastically about anybody. And he helped make that sports section really matter, even to the giants of straight news reporting, people like Woodward and Bernstein and the Post's top editor, Ben Bradley.
There was a democracy to the way Ben ran a newsroom and the way he walked through. I mean, when he walked through, everybody, look, that's Ben Bradley. But Ben would come to the sports section all the time and hang out. He hung out in the sports section with George and with everybody who was working at that time because he wanted to know about the football team and he wanted, you know, he wasn't as crazy about basketball, but football. He understood that was selling papers. Don Graham, who owned the paper in all the time that I was there, Don Graham loved basketball. Loved, you know, he mourned for the baseball team we didn't have, and then we got it again eventually. Loved football as well. So when you are dealing with large presences who like what you do, that it just makes it easier. Because there is, on many newspapers, there is an inherent prejudice against the sports section. It is the, you know, toys and games. Like, you people, you're not real reporters.
What is that newsroom like?
Greatest place ever. It's Monument Park in Yankee Stadium.
The word that often gets thrown around describing that newsroom at the Post, Tony, is lively. What was your role in the liveliness of that newsroom?
Well, I didn't have people sit on whoopee cushions or anything like that. Look, I'm chatty. Wilbon is chatty. We watch things, we talk about them, we get a little bit loud. Everybody in that section was that way. If you weren't chatty, what was the point of you working there?
when Kornheiser and Wilbon eventually became columnists, which was our good fortune, they had offices across the hall from each other, very close. And they would banter and yell and scream just as they do now on television. In fact, they did it so often that very often our neighbors, first the book world section, would come and say, is there any way you could get them, these two guys, to tone it down? I know this is a great shock to your crew and everybody at ESPN, but at times Tony tends to complain, and life would not be, you know, fulfilled if Kornheiser wasn't kvetching about something.
Your editor at the Washington Post, George Solomon, when we talked to him, he used the word kvetch over and over again.
You do that pretty well.
I'm trying.
Yeah.
I have to
practice
it.
It's not quite two syllables, but you've done well.
Kvetch.
It's not kvetch. It's kvetch.
Vetch. Kvetch.
Yeah. I don't know what he's talking about. I don't think of myself as a chronic complainer, which is what that would imply. I don't think of myself that way at all.
I know other people didn't like it. We didn't care. I know other people got tired of Tony and me being loud at 6:30 on deadline. We didn't give a damn. I still don't give a damn. I run into people occasionally who used to work at the Post who were like, you and Tony, I mean, congratulations, but my God, you were so distracting. And I want to throw up a middle finger. I know I shouldn't have that attitude, but I do.
Well, I've always said many times that I saw PTI 7 or 8 years before PTI was ever created, because my desk was kitty corner to their two desks. And every day, two people, these two hurricanes yelling at each other across the hallway.
David Aldridge is the editor-in-chief of the Washington Bureau of The Athletic, and he was at the Washington Post from 1987 to 1996.
And Tony would come out and say, what's the capital of Macedonia? And Mike would say, shut up, I got Jordan on the line. You know, so, and they would just yell at each other. And it was great theater. It was so entertaining. So I've read Mike for years before I was at the Post, you know, when he was covering Georgetown. And that was one of the glamour beats of the paper in the early 80s. As they rose to power and became a national championship team. So I read him, you know, religiously as he covered Georgetown all those years. Knew of him, didn't know him, obviously, until I got to the Post. There were very few people of color in covering sports in the early 80s. So you walk in a newsroom and you see a young guy who seems to know what he's talking about, and people tend to gravitate to. You know, he cuts an imposing figure right away. And you go, wow, okay. This young brother seems to know how to do this. I should listen to him. Tony wrote funny. It's hard to write funny. And it came across the page as funny. And so even well before I met Tony, I knew what his voice was, because his voice was present in everything that he wrote.
That back and forth, Mike and Tony's hurricane of dialogue, their differences playing out each day, that all left a lasting impression on all of the young people around them, which did not feel like an accident.
I'm J.A. Donda. I'm the director of sports journalism at Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism.
And a former Washington Post staff writer from 1994 to 1997.
At the Washington Post, George Solomon, the sports editor, like to have his people in the office. George would send you on the road very frequently, but when you were in town, he wanted you in the office. So that was a unique dynamic only at the Washington Post. And so the camaraderie, the relationship that developed between those two columnists, Mike and Tony, wouldn't have happened at any other newspaper in the country at that time.
You know, before they got on television, you'd want to come to the Washington Post to work just to be with those two guys. What I'm saying is that they're a joy to watch. They're a joy to listen to. If you had them in your house for more than 3 hours, would they be a joy? Maybe not.
George Solomon, their boss at the paper, knew Tony and Mike's chemistry was a special kind of magic, of human interaction, like so many others recognized it as. But trying to fit their newsroom dynamic into television, that was, shall we say, not the kind of risk that media companies generally love to take. So, coming up, how the show got its name and finally got on TV.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
So this whole idea to put two cantankerous, opinionated newspaper sports writers on television, it not only required some real creative imagination to make this all work on camera, it also needed a name.
Name's Jim Cohen. I was at ESPN for 17 years, and my last title was Vice President for Programming and Production.
Cohen is here to tell us that part.
Well, I can tell you what my opening paragraph was when we had our two-day think tank in Washington, and that sort of went for them also. And what I said was, we're here to create a new television show called Pardon the Interruption. Everything is up for discussion except the name of the show. Well, there was an elderly man, Joey Goldstein, who was a longtime sports publicist. And my understanding is that Mark was talking about the show to Joey.
That would be Mark Shapiro, remember. This is ESPN's new head of programming who wanted the thing in the first place.
And Mark told Joey about the show, and then Joey said, pardon the interruption. And then Mark said, that's it. That's the name of the show. What? Pardon the interruption, Joey. You just said it. That's the show.
Well, the executive producer, one Eric Rideholm, he didn't love it.
I just thought it was a terrible name. I didn't get it. I didn't know what it stood for. I had some other suggestions which were equally terrible. But we were told it was non-negotiable. And so what was wonderful about that is that we didn't have to spend any time thinking about it. And once we all had that, we thought it was great. Like, everything was great. Except Tony refused to say the words, pardon the interruption. The show was called Pardon the Interruption, and he refused to say the words because he hated the name so much. But he did agree to say PTI. So when you hear Tony, he's gotten it over now. He will say pardon the interruption every once in a while.
Pardon the interruption, but I'm Tony Kornheiser. I never go first. So there must be a really good reason.
Yeah.
Bam! Whoa! Left-handed! Awkward. Let me say that again.
But we always write in the scripts, welcome to PTI.
Welcome to PTI, boys and girls. In today's episode, Wilbon and I yap about juice balls and J-Lo.
Yeah. And Jim Cohen said, I only have two asks for this show, that it look like nothing else on television and that it's the best show on television. And we were like, was that it? I mean, that's a pretty tall ask, right?
Eric and his right-hand man, producer Matt Kelleher, came up with a look that was almost an anti-show. Because at this point in 2001, TV shows really wanted to be slick. They had a clock to keep hosts on track, but we in the audience never saw that. They had a roadmap for topics, how they'd move through the news, but that was exclusively for the producers backstage to see. But PTI decided to take those devices out from the control room and into the light, onto the screen. So the rundown became a menu along the right side of your television, one that basically anticipated the short attention spans of the internet, where everyone now could see what was coming next and how soon, so that if you didn't like whatever they were talking about in a given minute, you'd ostensibly stick around for the next. And at this point, you have undoubtedly seen all of these devices in this way across television, across cable news. But it started here.
But with the rundown, we realized it wasn't going to look like anything else on television. Matt had also developed the idea of a clock that we put on the rundown as well, that further differentiated.
I think that the Yankees' best pitcher has clearly been Messina to this point.
Yeah, well, the Seattle's not going to get to see Roger Clemens again anyway. That bell means we have to move on, and we're going to move on now to the National League, where the Diamondbacks are headed to the World Series.
The bell is like, for me, it's like a caution light, a yellow light as you're driving. You have to make a decision. Am I going through? Am I going to stop right now? And people are faced with that decision often, given traffic patterns. The bell for Mike, he doesn't even hear it. No. He's going through, and not only is he going through, if it comes back to me and I say something briefly, he'll go, oh, that's interesting, and then he'll do another 40 seconds.
Tony, I would agree with the call if it hadn't worked. You cannot get Patrick Mahomes the ball back if you got an option. You got the ball in your hands and a recent former MVP, run the damn ball. Some of the things now, Tony, everybody's got to be a little bit too smart.
I was hearing that last night because I was watching late into the night. Tony, the tennis, professional tennis, cannot just hang its hat on Serena Williams and Roger Federer forever and ever and ever, and not even Djokovic and Nadal. And so this is a welcome relief seeing these kids sort of ride to the rescue. And I haven't picked out one to love yet.
I mean, other than Houston wants to go with a complete rebuild and a youth movement, and Wall doesn't fit that. And he has said, okay, how do you want to handle this? So good for John Wall, makes him attractive to somebody else. But Tom, you mentioned the salary. Look, I know people have traded massive salaries before, but his seems...
I ask about the bell, Mike, because it doesn't seem like you listen to the bell that often.
Well, we know it's a suggestion we should stop. It's not a command.
If it's a command, you have been disobeying orders for 20 years. Mike.
Yeah, that's right. That's right, but it's a great device. Game changing.
Another thing that distinguished this show from the get-go was the fact that you and Tony looked right at each other.
Yeah.
And that was different and also seemingly important to you guys. Why was that?
Because this whole looking into the camera is that nothing as dumb as people looking directly into the camera. I don't mean when delivering the news, I get it. I watch television all my life. I'm a news junkie too. And we changed it. PTI changed that. Looking into the camera is stupid. It's like, why was this out there all these years? Looking into a camera, delivering a soliloquy. Dumb. Glad it's gone. Glad that PTI could help claim credit for getting that in mothballs. Good.
And so they had their mission. Be the best show in all of sports. And they had their look.
I thought, who is going to look at us? Why would anybody watch this junk?
Rob, yourselves versus what conventionally those people look like.
Well, I'll use a quote from one of the great television voices of all time, Howard Cosell. Howard Cosell now, please try to remember what Howard looked like. And Howard said of me, doesn't he know he's unsightly?
He does. And so for the first time ever, on Monday, October 22nd, 2001, Pardon the Interruption, PTI, goes on the air.
Pardon the interruption, but I'm Mike Wilbon, and welcome to opening day in this bizarre television experiment.
And I'm Tony Kornheiser, and if we can have a TV show, you can have a TV show.
And to be honest here, I find episode one incredibly jarring to watch now. And it's not because Kornheiser stumbled over the name of the show and a line he'd go on to say more than 5,000 times on TV.
Welcome to PTI. I don't even know the name yet.
Here's how it works.
And it's not even because 2001 Wilbon is conspicuously a little pudgier. What's so jarring is how instantly recognizable the entire thing is. The rhythm.
He's the starter.
Five-inning
setup,
I don't
think so. He's the Cy Young winner this year, and he hasn't gotten into the sixth inning in his starts. What
planet are you on? That's Joe Torre's decision.
K-Packs?
That's Joe Torre's decision.
The starter's got to get to the seventh or the eighth. Just like
Paul. The intimacy.
Pinella's decision to take him
out. Hello? He had given up 8 walks to that point. He was in danger of walking 93 people.
These are best against best. Those guys aren't going to
get the pace of conversation.
It's hard to argue with that, but the most dominant player so far in the entire postseason is Curt Schilling. If he did not win game 3...
Ahead of Derek Jeter?
Yes, by far ahead of Derek Jeter, and here's why.
No way.
He has pitched 3 complete games in Arizona.
It's kind of like discovering an old home video of your parents dancing. And then realizing exactly how little they've changed. And with that officially out in the world, the results come in. The American public responds. And the televised poodle business is never the same again. That's part 2.